That's good. Welcome back to History on the Rocks podcast. This is your host, Cody, and of course, joining me, we're back, my wife, Audrey.
We're back.
Yes, it was a much needed week off.
Yeah, it was.
I didn't have any material written for that week, so it worked out kind of perfectly. And then we were in Nashville.
Yeah, we were busy.
For your sister Haley's 21st birthday, and we both did not have voices when we got back.
Definitely did not. Nope.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, though.
It was. It was a good time.
Yeah. But we are back this week, and we are bringing you a episode about historical betrayals.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a theme that it's a new theme to the podcast. We haven't repeated any of the new ones yet, but I figured these would be kind of fun because the ones that we're going to talk about today, one, changed the course of a very prominent European country's history. The other one changed the whole history of the nation of India, plus its subcontinent, which is South Asia.
Oh.
So, two kind of big betrayals in history today that kind of change two big countries in a big way.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, we'll get into those. But what are we drinking?
I am back to drinking some Blue Moon.
Just Blue Mooning it up.
Yeah, it doesn't really feel appropriate at the time of day to be having a glass of whiskey, but
it's almost 5 o'clock.
It feels like it's a lot earlier.
It's not.
Well,
and if it's gonna be 5 o'clock somewhere, it's about to be 5 o'clock here. You can have whiskey whenever you want. You're on summer break.
True. But I still have to, you know, parent. So
yeah, we have to parent. She's taking a nap right now. I mean, a glass of whiskey's not gonna do anything to you at 4:15. I don't even know what time it is. All right.
Well, what are you drinking?
Oh. Bush Light.
Nice. In a bottle.
In a bottle.
Fancy.
So it's classy. If it's in a bottle, it's classy. If it's in a can.
Whatever you have to tell yourself.
Well, you're probably just camping.
I do prefer Blue Moon in a bottle, or obviously draft is better for pretty much anything, but I had it in a can in Nashville. I was like, this is not good.
Yeah, I told you before you had it in a can.
Not good.
We talked about that, and I said Blue Moon does not believe in or belong in a can.
No.
I said that on this podcast, I think.
You might have.
I think it was the last episode. I literally said Blue Moon does not belong in a can.
No.
And it doesn't because it's got that acidic orange taste.
Yeah.
And when you put it in tin, just like orange juice in like, what do you call it? Like a one of those, you know, aluminum bottles.
Yeah.
It tastes like battery acid.
Mm. Yeah, it's not disgusting. Good. I think I actually tossed it. Like, I did not finish drinking it.
Yeah, I don't even know why they make Blue Moon in cans, to be honest. Anything that comes out of a keg is perfect. Anything that comes out of a bottle is semi-perfect. Anything that comes out of a can, well, it's cheaper and you're just desperate, obviously. Well, or you don't want to make a mess.
Yeah, it's cheap, but yeah.
Like, I don't want to drink anything out of a can, like, ever. I would rather have it in a bottle.
Yeah.
Preferably on draft. Even though people are like, oh, the draft lines are disgusting. It's like people, they clean their draft lines.
Yeah, you never know. But
I clean ours in our kegerator right before I put a new keg on, gets washed out.
Well, yeah, but you're not using it on a daily basis like restaurants are. I don't know.
I worked in the restaurant industry. Like, I know they clean their taps out.
I'm sure some don't as often as they should. Well, but
then, you know what? The health inspector should be in there.
I'm not a germaphobe.
No. Well, and the alcohol kills a lot of the, you know, nasty shit anyway. Yeah. So, all right. Well, let's get into some historical betrayals before our baby wakes up.
Sounds good. Yeah. We're on a time crunch here because it's hit or miss.
All right. Both of these actually are very prevalent to what's going on today in today's society. So we'll talk about that a little bit too. But the first one is called the Alfred Dreyfus Affair. And this is a historical event that rocked the nation of France and revealed some deep-seated prejudices and had far-reaching implications for justice and civil rights. It has to do with anti-Semitism. So that's why I think this is a really interesting story, is because, well, anti-Semitism is all in the media today.
Yeah, for sure.
With the war going on between Israel and Hamas and Palestine, whatever, not going to get into it. But you know the anti-Semitism's been floating around, mm-hmm. Especially on social media, which I just think is so interesting because it's like, didn't we just, we had a Holocaust like less than 100 years ago and like Jewish hate's back. It's amazing. Talk about not learning from history.
Yeah.
19th century France. This is a time of political instability, rampant anti-Semitism. The French military is revered as a nation's protector. The French military at this time is very strong, very abundant. In its ranks, though, there is this scandal that exposes the dark underbelly of prejudice and injustice. So the story begins with a man named Captain Alfred Dreyfus. He's a promising young officer in the French army. Dreyfus is born into a Jewish family in 1859 and worked hard to rise through its ranks, embodying the ideals of the French Republic, which is liberty, equality, and fraternity. He graduated from École Polytechnique Military School in Paris in 1880. After receiving specialized artillery training, he was promoted to lieutenant in the French military in 1885. He was promoted to captain in 1889, later becoming the only Jew serving in the French Army's General Staff headquarters in 1893.
Interesting.
For the 1800s, that really, like, that piece of information kind of shocked me, that he was the only Jew in the General Staff headquarters in the late 1890s, or in the late 1800s, in the 1890s.
Why is that so surprising?
Because it's the 1890s, and, like, I guess anti-Semitism has been a thing for a long time, now that I'm thinking about it, but, I mean, yeah, I guess Hitler, 1930s and 40s, it's going to come back in the most evil kind of way. But, like, that just shows how anti-Semitism has kind of snowballed throughout history, mm-hmm. is that there's a small group, you know, the Jews, they're a ethnic religion. You're born into it. They're an ethnicity. And somehow they're blamed for a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And, like, I can go back and there might be some proof of, you know, Jewish resentment, but again, I'd have to go dig, and mm-hmm. I'm not digging right now, so I just think it's weird that, like, France, like, the Jewish population is pretty large in Europe at the time, and, like, in France, especially, France, in my eyes, is always, like, one of those countries, like, on those, you know, like, the ideals of the French Republic, liberty, equality, and fraternity. It's like, who cares who you are? Like, if you're French, you're French.
Yeah, but they hate us.
The French hate us?
Yeah, don't they?
Well, the French can... I'm going to lose listeners. I don't even care. I'm going to say it. The French have done nothing. They have done nothing in the last 100 years. World War One, they failed. World War Two, we saved their ass. Vietnam. I don't know how many times the United States would have to save France's ass and why they would hate us.
Yeah.
You know? They're just a very artsy kind of country. Fashion.
They seem, like, pretentious.
France is... I've heard people go to France, like American friends who have gone to France, and said it's a very pretentious country. Now, I'm not going to just generalize anyone on our podcast, but I've heard that people in France have, like, they're not that nice. That's just what I've heard.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's why I have never been there. I have not heard a whole lot, but, like, I just see it as very, yes, pretentious, hoity-toity, and I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly, my bias thinks the same thing of France. Like, that's why, like, when we go to Germany, like, we went to France for a day.
Yeah.
And, like,
the people in Bitch,
yeah, literally, the city's called Bitch France. They have a big citadel there from the Prussian era, which was actually pretty cool to see. And the people actually in that town were nice. I mean, we went to the cafe. And
But
I think when you get into the more urban settings, it's more pretentious.
Like Paris.
Like, Paris is pretentious, I mm-hmm. would think. Like, Bitch is a small south eastern city of France by the German border, and, like, I think the people there were really nice.
Yeah.
Just walking around and going into the cafe and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't really interact with that many people,
no,
but the people we did interact with in the smaller towns, they were very, like,
and we were
humble,
with
nice people. Yeah, and we were with our German family, so. But hey, if you're French and you're listening to this, go ahead, shoot me a message. I have no hate for you at all. It's just our inkling over here in the States is that the French really don't like us for some reason.
It's a total, like, bias that we have that we don't really know anything. Like, we don't have anything
and
to
we'll totally admit
back
that.
It.
We'll totally admit that. And at the same time, like, you know, let us know. Like, why do you have animosity towards us? Because I'm pretty sure we've saved your country multiple times and you'd be speaking German if it wasn't for, you know, the Brits in the U.S. Now that I brought the Brits into it, they're probably really going to hate me for that comment, but... It's true. I mean, the French have almost been taken over twice in one century, and needed intervention from other powers of the world to get them out of it. They really didn't fight themselves out. It's just a historical fact.
Yep.
I don't know. Moving on.
Yep.
All right. So we were just talking about how Alfred Dreyfus, he's the only Jewish man in the French Army's general staff headquarters serving. This is 1893. His Jewish heritage made him a target in an institution filled with anti-Semitic sentiments. So the French army, the French military already has anti-Semitic sentiments built into it at this time. So, I mean, there's that little factoid. In 1894, a document known as the Bordereau was discovered. And this detailed the French military secrets that had been passed to the Germans in the late 1800s. Suspicion quickly fell on Dreyfus, not because of solid evidence, but because he was an easy target as the only Jewish officer in a critical position, meaning he had the knowledge of these secrets, and that, like, maybe because he was a Jew, that this anti-Semitic sentiment towards him, he might be spilling secrets to an enemy, which is sure. Germany, obviously.
Yeah.
So on October 15th, 1894, Dreyfus is arrested for treason. The evidence against him was very flimsy, largely based on a handwriting sample that comes from that Bordereau document, which was allegedly similar to his. You know, handwriting samples.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think some of my kids in school have similar handwriting. I don't know how one guy out of many military men could have just one distinct kind of handwriting, but you never know. Despite this, there's a secret trial held in which falsified testimonies were told about Dreyfus. The military court inevitably convicted him, and on January 5th, 1895, Dreyfus was publicly stripped of his rank in a humiliating ceremony and sent to the infamous Devil's Island in French Guinea, down in South America. Basically, he had no chance.
Yeah.
It was like a mock trial in which they did it for show.
Yeah.
Just to say, hey, we
did it.
We put him through due process, and we didn't just send him to an island and exile
him.
But
he's guilty.
He's guilty, no matter what. And there's really no solid evidence of this at all. Like, they have this handwriting sample, and that's about it.
Yeah. I feel like that says, like, as good as a lie detector test.
Yeah. It was so admissible
in court. Shouldn't
be
admissible in court.
Yeah, it's something that doesn't prove guilt at all.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
It's all circumstantial, and especially lie detector tests. Like, myself with anxiety, taking a lie detector test, I bet you I fail that every time.
Well, you're just already, you're already under stress.
But I guess they get a baseline. They get a baseline reading. So I guess if you're under stress, you're going to have that baseline reading. And if you get more stress and you're lying, it's going to even go more off the charts.
Yeah, but, like, there are some times where I'm like, somebody, like, you might think I'm lying, but, like, I'm really telling the truth, but, like, my face is going to show, like, I'm totally lying, but, like, I'm not. But, like, you think I'm lying.
Right.
So,
well,
like,
you're one of those smilers. You're one of those smile, like with secrets and lies, or like even if you're telling the truth, like you do that smiling thing where people like don't believe you.
Yeah, like it could be either way. Like, I guess I could be lying, or I am totally telling the truth, but it's making it seem like I'm lying. But
now, Devil's Island in the French New Guinea, or French Guinea, Devil's Island is a remote, brutal penal colony. It would become Dreyfus's home for the next 5 years of his life. During this time, his family and a few loyal advocates tirelessly work to prove his innocence. And among them is his brother, Matthew Dreyfus, and a journalist named Bernard Lazare, who began to uncover the extent of the injustice towards Alfred Dreyfus. Now, the breakthrough comes in 1896 when Colonel George Picquart, Georges Picquart? I don't know. It sounds right to me. Head of the Army's counterintelligence section discovered evidence that the real traitor was a man named Major Ferdinand Walson Esterhazy.
What a name.
Yes.
Wow.
Ferdinand Walson Esterhazy. However, when Picquart went to report his findings, they silenced him and transferred him to a remote post. The military establishment was more concerned with protecting its reputation than actually seeking the truth against Alfred Dreyfus. Now, in 1898, a man named Emile Zola, one of France's most renowned writers, penned an open letter titled "Jacques," which was published on the front page of the newspaper La Aurier.
Your French is just so good.
Zola's bold move exposed the Dreyfus affair to the public and sparked widespread outrage and debate. the public pressure became too great to ignore, and in 1899, Dreyfus was brought back to France for a second trial. Now, despite overwhelming evidence of his innocence, he was once again found guilty, though this time with, quote-unquote, extenuating circumstances. However, due to the intense public scrutiny, Dreyfus was offered a presidential pardon, which he accepted, though it was not an admission of guilt. So, let's piece that part together, okay? Mm-hmm. They bring him back for a second trial from French Guinea, right? Yep. He's been exiled for 5 years on this island, I guess. It's like a prison island. And I'm pretty sure this is another bullshit trial, because the extenuating circumstances in this case make me think that they're still trying to protect the military establishment's ass,
mm-hmm.
and then give him a presidential pardon by saying, like, okay, we're going to let you off, but we're not going to allow you to say that you're innocent.
Yeah.
You know, so that it's kind of like, well, the military did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
Even though it did. It wasn't until 1906 that Dreyfus was fully exonerated by a civilian court and reinstated into the army with the rank of major. He continued to serve France honorably, fighting in World War I, and later retiring quietly. Now, the Dreyfus affair, that's loyal, okay? That is real loyalty from a civilian. If you screwed him over like that, and then he continues to serve in your military, especially in one of the greatest wars of all time, World War I, and then just retires quietly without, like, a fuss.
Yeah.
Like, that's a dude. Like, I don't care who you are. Like, that's a dude.
Yeah. Don't make us think about it. Just move on.
Yeah. I would have... Shit. I would have been like, fuck you.
You were wrong.
Yeah. I'm not serving in this military anymore if you're going to play this on me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Dreyfus affair had lasting impacts on French society and politics. It exposed the deep-rooted anti-Semitism within the military and broader society, leading to significant reforms. The affair also highlighted the critical role of the media and public opinion in challenging injustice and defending the principles of democracy and human rights. Now, if we look at the Dreyfus affair in today's world, it serves as a stark reminder of the dangers of prejudice and the importance of vigilance in the pursuit of justice.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds us that the fight against injustice is never truly over, and that each generation must strive to uphold the values of truth, equality, and human dignity.
Yeah.
Basically, we have so much going on in our world that it's so easy to scapegoat people.
Oh, totally.
And, like, you can tell, like, even in politics, it's like in American politics, it happens in other countries around the world too, but how easy it is to scapegoat people and then, like, totally just, like, smokescreen the whole thing. And be like, oh, this is the truth. And it's really not.
Yeah.
Like, it has people going, what is the truth? And then you go into this dark spiral of, like, is this true or not? You know? Like, I think that story just speaks volumes when, like, about today's society.
Mm-hmm.
About, like, screwing people over and just letting them take the fall, even though they're completely innocent.
Yeah.
And then never finding out the truth because the, you know, bigger establishment has all the secrets.
Well, and it's, like, maybe in his... like, mind was like, it's not worth a fight.
Well, it's not worth a fight because he's going to lose.
Yeah, because you're always going to lose with the people in higher power.
Yeah, you're up against people with all this power, and, like, what's the point? I'm not going to waste my energy. Let me just move on from this.
Yep.
You know?
For sure.
All right. Now, our second story, and I saved this one for the end, obviously, as a second story, because this one is something I didn't even know about British colonization of the country of India. And explains a lot about why India is the way it is today. Very impoverished country, and very highly populated, like overpopulated, right? This is called Mir Jafar and the Battle of Plassey. This betrayal has to do with the pivotal moment in the history of India where it officially fell to British colonization. This is a story of betrayal that altered the course of the entire subcontinent of South Asia. And this betrayal of Mir Jafar happened at the Battle of Plassey. The story starts in the mid-1700s, when India was a land of immense wealth and diverse cultures, but also of political fragmentation and colonial ambitions. The Mughal Empire, once a mighty force, was in decline, and regional powers were competing for dominance. Among these was the Nawab of Bengal, Siraj ud Dala. A Nawab is kind of like a... I don't want to say a king, but like a what we would like be a president, like would be a president or like a governor of an area. And like, this is important because this empire, the Mughal Empire, in it, once an empire is in its decline, it fragments. People now are looking to grab power and reinstate their own power to pretty much push out the old government and start anew.
Yeah.
Right? So that's kind of where India is at this time. Now, Siraj Udaula ascended to power in 1756, inheriting control over one of India's wealthiest provinces. However, his rule was constantly challenged from within and without, meaning from people within India and colonial forces outside, like the British East India Company. If you've ever watched Pirates of the Caribbean, this is who we're talking about, the East India Trading Company. This is a trading corporation, and it has its own private army, and it's an expanding influence in South Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tensions between Siraj and the British escalated, culminating in the infamous capture of Calcutta and the incident known as the Black Hole of Calcutta. So right away, you have the British taking advantage of a falling empire and a leader who is losing his rule over his province.
Yeah.
In response, the British sent a military expedition under the command of Robert Clive, a shrewd and ambitious military officer. Clive aimed to restore British control and secure the company's interests in Bengal. This would set the stage for a confrontation that would decide the fate of Bengal. On June 23, 1757, the two forces met at Plassey, which is a small village on the banks of the Bhagirathi River. I nailed that, by the way.
Isn't it Bengal?
Bengal. Bengal. I say Bengal.
Bengal.
Bengal. You can say it either way. I don't know. Bengal. I say Bay of Bengal, like the Bay of Bengal. That's like right off the coast.
Bay of Bengal.
Bay of Bengal.
I
whatever.
Feel like I've heard Bengal, but I could be totally wrong. But just
you might have. It might be. It might be pronounced differently. Like
that's true.
I mean, Bengal, Bengal. I mean, when I look at this word B N G A L, like the Cincinnati Bengals. That's how you say it. So I say Bengal.
Well, I don't know.
I don't know. Just my English. However, Siraj Udaula commanded an army vastly superior in numbers, but his position was far from secure. Among his commanders was a man named Mir Jafar, who was a senior military leader who had ambitions of his own rule. Ooh, shocking. You know, when one ruler is falling, there's always someone ready to take their place.
Yep.
Mir Jafar, disillusioned with Siraj's leadership and enticed by promises of power and wealth, entered into a secret pact with Robert Clive. In exchange for his support in overthrowing Siraj, Mir Jafar was promised the throne of Bengal, or Bengal.
Bengal.
As the battle commenced, the British forces found themselves outnumbered and seemingly outmatched. However, Mir Jafar's betrayal would soon tip the scales in the favor of the British. Instead of engaging, Mir Jafar and his troops stood by and refused to fight. This critical inaction sowed the confusion and demoralization within Siraj's ranks. The tide quickly turned in favor of the British here, and Siraj Udaula, realizing the treachery too late, attempted to flee the battlefield, but was eventually captured and executed by the British.
Hmm.
The Battle of Plassey was over, and the British had emerged victorious, thanks in large part to Mir Jafar's betrayal. With Siraj Udaula removed, Mir Jafar was installed as the Nawab of Bengal. However, his rule was largely puppet-like, because the real power resided in the hands of the British East India Company. The company's influence grew, and Bengal became a cornerstone of British colonial rule in India. So Mir Jafar was promised this leader, like this role as the Nawab, and he betrays Siraj and pretty much the people of India to gain that power.
Mm-hmm.
And then he becomes a puppet figure for the British East India Company to just do whatever they want in this region. And that's why colonial rule in India becomes so prevalent with the British and becomes a total colony of Britain. It's just because of this one betrayal in a battle that the British probably would have lost without Mir Jafar's help. So it paved the way for nearly 200 years of British dominance over the India subcontinent, leading to profound economic, social, and cultural changes. Mir Jafar's name has since become synonymous with treachery in Indian history, symbolizing the devastating impact of betrayal on a nation's destiny. Now, if we're looking back at this episode, it's essential that we consider the broader implications of these types of betrayals.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't just Mir Jafar taking power. It impacted India up to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the subcontinent of South Asia, it's demoralizing. Impoverished, mm-hmm. overpopulated, economy sucks. I mean, there's the social unrest is ridiculous.
Yeah.
They don't have any like running water in most villages and cities. Mm. Like it's and the culture is completely different of how prominent India was back before any of this happened.
Yeah.
And this one man's ambition, his ambition for power led to imperialism and mm-hmm. a relationship with the British who will now command it for the years to come.
Yeah.
So, like, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, that is.
You go back to, like, American history and, like, Benedict Arnold, who, you know, turned on the colonists, you know, during the War of Independence. And, like, that doesn't seem like a big deal mm-hmm. because, you know, the Americans, like, the colonists still won and yeah. we became our own country. But, like, it makes me think of, like, what that betrayal could have really done. You know what I mean? Like, where would the United States be now?
Yeah,
if we didn't obviously win our independence and like Benedict Arnold's treachery and him turning on his own colonists, like
who knows
what would have happened? I'll be speaking like this, mate. I'm drinking tea and eating crumpets.
Pinkies up.
Yeah, I already made fun of one European country today. I'm not going to go for a second. We love our British people. I don't know. Yeah. They got some issues going on over there right now. Just like us, we all need to figure it out because things are not going the right direction in Europe or the United States.
No.
So, I don't know. Someone figure something out. Someone betray someone. Change something.
Yeah, let's change the course for the people.
Well, I thought these were two really interesting stories. Historic betrayals, like, you don't realize the impact of them until, you know, you kind of look back on history and see what people have done that have changed the course of history, especially mm-hmm. in some of these countries. Like, the first story was for the better, right? You
yeah.
know, you're exposing anti-Semitism, you're exposing the military establishment for being unfair to people.
Yeah.
But then you have the story like Mir Jafar, in which a whole continent and a large country has just completely imploded and
changed
has not
course.
Gotten any better. You know, it was once a very prominent, wealthy society, and now it's a very poor and,
yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, it's a very dirty,
impoverished,
dirty country. Like I said, the continent of India doesn't have a lot of running water, sanitation. The people don't live comfortably. They're all, you know, overpopulation. The big urban areas are all stacked on
yeah.
top of each other. So it's kind of unfortunate that, like you hear these stories and it's like, okay, that's history. But people don't understand, like, how impactful history mm-hmm. is, like, especially in the modern day. So I don't know. I like the historic betrayals. I'm going to find some other good ones.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Hey, we're back this week. We hope you enjoyed this episode of History on the Rocks podcast. We gave away some shirts.
Yeah.
Last week.
Seen the videos and posts coming in of people getting them.
The 80th anniversary of D-Day was last Thursday. So even though we weren't on here talking, we still wanted to do something kind of to keep y'all engaged while we took a week off. And we had 5 winners, I believe 3 on Facebook, 2 on Instagram.
Whoop, whoop.
Yeah, we got some videos back of them opening their packages.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. So, yeah, we're excited for that. If you want a History on the Rocks podcast T-shirt, reach out to me on either Facebook or Instagram. I would be more than happy to get those to you.
It's Father's Day this weekend.
Happy Father's Day to all you fathers out there.
Happy Father's Day, babe.
Appreciate it. I know a lot of you will be golfing, grilling, because I will be golfing and grilling.
I was going to say, we haven't even talked about your plans on Sunday yet.
Yeah. But, yep, happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. You know, you're heroes too.
Yes. Just not as much as moms.
Yeah. Well, moms go through the ringer. Us dads are just there to support. But
hey, they do a lot of great work.
We do a lot
too.
Of work. So enjoy your weekend. It's going to be a nice one here. I know that. So hopefully
where
warm. You
are,
it's getting warm here. But hopefully where you are, you have a nice Father's Day weekend. Go relax, have some drinks, visit some family and friends. And we will see you, talk to you next week on the History on the Rocks podcast.
Cheers.
Cheers.